In 2007, Noel Tichie and Warren Bennis wrote a book, Judgment, How Winning Leaders Make Great Calls, put out by Portfolio Publishing. The interesting thing about their book and their work is how important being able to successfully make judgment calls is to the experience and expression of leadership in so many critical ways. I thought it might be really valuable to spend some time looking at the leadership role of judgment calls and getting into what both Tichie and Bennis suggest are the fundamental elements of good judgment and of making good judgment calls. Their argument is that it is, as all leadership skills are, a developed skill, a skill that can be refined and developed through study, application, and through good analysis on the part of the individual and leadership teams. So making a judgment call really means understanding the nature of the judgment call and to be able to analyze and understand the elements and characteristics of judgment calls in a way that can break them down and then incorporate them logically and analytically into the pattern of behavior of you as a leader. The first phase of judgment, which is preparation according to them, incorporates three major steps. The first step is to sense and to identify the issue, which really entails reading the early signs, being a good signpost reader, being able to predict and to adapt to what those early signals are. Second, it is to frame and to name the issue, setting clear parameters and providing a context for it. And third is to mobilize and align the key stakeholders who will respond to it, making sure that their contribution, their engagement of it, and the harnessing of their energy will be a part of your response. They suggest that good leaders make a habit of the sensing, framing, and aligning so that they are personally prepared for the call. This anticipatory leadership, it becomes a real critical skill set that they see as a fundamental part of their own leadership development. This is particularly important when one anticipates crisis situations. The likelihood in a crisis situation of making a good call is considerably reduced, and so that can be offset significantly if the call can be made within the context of a storyline, of a trajectory, so that you can begin within the context of the storyline, see the various elements and characteristics that relate to that storyline. The constant sensing and framing become really critical to being prepared for the crisis judgment call. If you take as an example an emergency department and a level one trauma center, you can see that during the down times or the quiet times, the nurses and staff are looking at the preparation for the crisis by making sure that all of the components, elements, materials, supplies, and processes are in place for when the crisis occurs. For a trauma center, crisis is the normal course of doing business. Therefore, being prepared for it, being in place and making sure that everything necessary is in place for it becomes a routine ritual, a part of the job, the storyline of the crisis. The crisis itself is no longer the issue. The preparation for the crisis makes the crisis a common, normal set of behaviors. Like leaders, triage nurses use the trauma storyline to guide their calls, in this case, the crisis calls of emergency. These storylines for the nurses are based on their nursing and clinical knowledge, as well as the values that help the nurses apply that knowledge. Tichie and Bennis relate another exemplar for developing a storyline of an emergency operation where a triage nurse quickly chose to keep a feverish child and her parents waiting while she mobilized a team to deal with an elderly man in cardiac arrest. It seemed like a pretty logical decision since the febrile child was not in crisis and the man in cardiac arrest was. But in the course of attending to both, a trickier call arose in the emergency room. A pregnant teenage girl came into the ER with a gunshot wound, and the triage nurse, without hesitation, pulled the team off the cardiac arrest of the old man and reassigned it to the pregnant girl. The elderly gentleman died, but the baby and the girl survived. Here, the triage nurse relied not only on her clinical expertise regarding the two patients, but on her insight and values to make the kind of call that would best use limited healthcare resources. Here, her storyline led her to value the younger lives and the clinical activity devoted to them over that of the elderly man who was in extreme crisis and not likely to survive it. Whether it is right or wrong, her judgment reflected a particular and clear and a very easily justifiable set of values. Here, her storyline, and having that storyline, helped her frame choices. Well, having a storyline for the leader with regard to particular kinds of judgment calls will also frame choices. It allows the leader to look at the events that may be influenced or changed by this story. It allows the leader to pick up the faint signals in the environment that can proactively help that leader make judgment calls and not be surprised by situations and events. In building a storyline, there's a little element called a redo loop. And that occurs in the preparation phase, and it comes when you as a leader discover that you really can't mobilize and align the organizational resources, perhaps because the issue hasn't been framed or hasn't been framed correctly from the beginning. Rather than getting stuck or overwhelmed or digging in your heels, as a good leader, you go back to the story, you go back to the situation, you go back to the occurrence, you go back to history, and you reconsider the decisions that were made, the conditions and circumstances of that event, and you rewrite the storyline so that as you relabel and redevelop and reconfigure the elements of the story, you begin again to be better prepared and more clearly configured to address the needs of the judgment call when it invariably arises at a later date. Now, the call phase of the judgment process is about the quickest part of the process. It's almost as quick, the author suggests, as a flip of the switch. A good leader does a great deal of consulting with others, and then after that consultation, a decision is made. The decision that's made is quick. The consultation and building the database is not so quick. In fact, the call itself is where the traditional view of judgment starts and ends. What people don't realize is that a lot goes into that judgment call. Just because the judgment call is made quickly doesn't mean that it isn't informed and it isn't developed. Judgments and judgment calls, when they're made, are really informed by particular types of knowledge that guide the judgment call in a meaningful way. Tiki and Bennis suggest that there are four types of knowledge that guide these judgments: self-knowledge, social networks, organizational knowledge, and contextual knowledge. If they break each one of them down, there are elements of each of those four that have impact on people, strategy, and crisis. For example, the questions that relate to self-knowledge is what is your method of learning? How do you learn? How do you face reality? What is your particular way of dealing with your own reality? Do you watch and do you listen? Are you open? Are you responsive? Are you willing to improve? Are you willing to become personally engaged in the change? When that is directed towards people, personal judgments about your ambitions, your role, and your capabilities are in evidence and can be visualized and transferred to them in ways that they can see where you are in terms of your self-knowledge and your self-perception. In terms of strategy, your personal judgments regarding your career and life strategy have an impact in the strategic choices and strategic competence that you bring to your work roles. And in terms of crisis, your ability to answer these questions about the self gives some idea of your personal judgments made during times of crisis and introspection, so that who you are and what you know of yourself informs what you'll do with regard to people, with regard to your impact on strategy, and with your way of handling crisis. Second, when you look at social network as a knowledge area, it raises the questions about how, as you a leader, do you know how to build a strong team? Can you build the relationships and the interactions and intersections necessary for a team to operate effectively? How do you learn from your team members? Are you as able to learn as you are to lead a team? And how do you teach them to make better judgments? Remember, in your social network and building your team effectiveness and competence, the impact on people demonstrates how judgments about who is on and off your team are well made by you and facilitated by your ability. In terms of the team's role with regard to strategy, judgments about how your team evolves to meet new, increasingly important business or clinical or critical demands for your organization. And finally, in terms of crisis, it affects judgments about how and with whom your team operates during a crisis, so that developing this cohesiveness, this network, this linkage between the essential team members and building that relationship can have a dramatic impact on your relationship with other people, on the implementation of the strategy of the organization, and the response to the organization's crisis. The third type of knowledge is organizational. Do you know how to draw on the strengths of others throughout the organization? Can you create broad-scale processes by teaching people to make smart judgments regardless of where they are? Can smart judgments and making good judgments be a part of the developmental skills, measurement, analysis, and evaluation of individuals in leadership roles, so that organizationally you have a frame of reference, an expectation, a set of principles, and of role skills that can make judgments successfully, regardless of where you're located, across the organization, so that the ability to make critical decisions and to make them well and to undertake the processes associated with making them is placed at any number of critical locations in the organization. And the impact on people with regard to the organizational skills across the organization relate to judgments about organizational systems that ensure the quality and capability of people within the organization. With regard to impact on strategy, judgments about how to engage and align all the organizational levels in strategic execution, and knowing that that competence is located at critical and important places in the organization. And in terms of crisis, judgments about how to work with the organization during times of critical decision making, having the confidence and the competence to know that no matter where those decisions are made in the organization, the ability to make them crosses the organization and is present in key leaders no matter where they are. And final of the four types of knowledge is contextual knowledge. It raises the issue and the questions as to whether you know how to create smart interactions among myriad stakeholders, such as customers or patients or members or suppliers or payers or regulators or competitors, whoever is a part of the contextual framework environment within which your organization and your work endeavors are unfolding. And that impacts judgments with regard to people when you're thinking of contextual impact in making judgments about which stakeholders are important and how to particularly engage them in ways that are meaningful and valuable for them and the organization. Impact on strategy with regard to judgments about engaging stakeholders to help frame and define and to execute the strategic direction of the organization so that all players who are part of that are fully engaged in it and know what it means. And finally, the contextual implications with regard to judgments in crisis, judgments about how stakeholders both inside and outside the organization connect to be able to mutually resolve a crisis and to be able to obtain some benefit and positive outcome related to it. After a good judgment call has been made, that is not the end of exercising good judgment. Execution is the most basic means of making sure that the call actually happens as intended. Once a call is made, a leader needs to be able to mobilize the necessary resources and people and information and technology that will support it and make it work. Here is where redo loops are really developed as you begin to execute the call and evaluate the processes associated with it. Those evaluations and subsequent analysis helps create the foundations for redoing, for conceptualizing and configuring the judgment call as one begins to analyze the effectiveness and the impact of activities on that particular judgment call. The issues related to execution are really critically important when one begins to recognize that most of the breakdown in effectiveness with regard to a judgment call is the goodness of fit with regard to its execution and the impact or outcome that was intended or actually obtained. If execution is good, the judgment between what was intended and what actually occurred demonstrates a real tightness of fit. If it wasn't, the outcomes and impact generally relate in no way to the decisions that were made and the activities that were undertaken to implement that decision. Consequently, strategic judgment fails and now informs the system with regard to what needs to happen. Number one, immediately to take care of the problem that hasn't been resolved by previous activities, and number two, to begin to set up a database for making decisions about the next judgment call that will reflect many of the same elements of the current judgment call. These are really just the basic elements of a judgment call. They begin to help the leader shape insights with regard to what the components of preparation and of readiness for good judgment calls are. Often, the view that people have with regard to a judgment call is based essentially on the call itself, thinking that the call is reactionary and responds to an immediate critical situation that has never existed before, never happened before, and calls into place behaviors and patterns of roles that are new and unique to the particular situation within which the judgment call arose. That is simply not true. There are previous situations and dynamics requiring judgment calls that have many of the same elements and characteristics that any judgment call would have. Those who make good judgment calls are ones who are closely in touch with that series of elements that inform the decision, that prepare the individual for making that decision, that put in place activities and actions that will occur subsequent to the decision, and also incorporate and assure that there are assessments and analysis of the call that better prepares the next judgment call, even though the critical situation may itself be significantly different. The research of these authors reveal that two things are sure. One is that the best leaders get the most out of important calls and get those calls right. And they get those calls right because they're prepared for them. The chronicle of a leader's judgment calls is actually the leader's biography. The other issue is that when it comes to a judgment call, the only thing that counts is making sure that the call is right. Enthusiasm and good intention and hard work, plus a dose of preparation, of application, of analysis and evaluation, helps. But what people will always remember is the successful and effective outcome. The more prepared, the more understandable what goes into a judgment call the leader expresses, the more well-considered the process, the more reflective and accurate the collective wisdom that goes into the judgment call, the better the judgment call, and the better the commitment to good results. And that's what informs the foundations of making a good judgment call and of leading people to positive outcomes that will result in a meaningful and viable and sustainable, healthy organization as a result. Because this was a relatively short podcast on judgment calls, I thought I would end this podcast with a little bit of information on some of the elements of innovation leadership and some of the things that affect innovation leadership. there's been a lot of research on organizations being able to flexibly and fluidly shift to new realities or to adjust to new paradigms. And so one of the things I think that it might be valuable is just to share just very briefly some of the elements that have been learned related to responding to a paradigm shift and what helps make organizations successful in doing so. Rosabeth Moss Kanter, in the January issue of Harvard Business Review 2008, did an extensive article on research that she and others in her practice have undertaken with regard to how giant organizations are transformed. And out of their research and their thinking, they were able to come up with some basic principles that help them and organizational leaders know when a paradigm is actually shifting, help them know when long-standing contradictions actually begin to resolve. In their research team, they were struck by the number of areas where these organizations could achieve a balance between what seemed to be opposing goals. And the following key elements were areas where they noticed that that operated significantly and made a huge difference or had an impact on successful organizations being able to make that sea change towards adjusting to a major paradigm shift. First, they noticed that these organizations both globalized and localized well, and that they derived their benefits in the organizations from the intersection between globalization and localization. Second, they noticed that these organizations both standardized and innovated. They endeavored to prevent consistency from being stiffly conformity. It was conformity that was the enemy of innovation. And the issue is that there is a distinct need to standardize where possible in terms of processes, and to individualize in terms of innovations and applications. Third, these organizations that make a paradigm shift well foster a common universal culture, but also are able to respect individual differences. In other words, they seek inclusion and diversity, and find in both inclusion and diversity the essential characteristics of innovation. Unless there is sufficient diversity in the organization, there isn't the energy and creativity and insight necessary to drive innovation. Fourth, these organizations that survive and thrive in the paradigm shift maintain control by actually letting go of most of it. Instead, they began to initiate mechanisms where trusting people, educated in their shared values to do the right thing, was the predominant frame for the organization. That individual trust of the people of the organization, by engaging them, by investing them, by incorporating them into the strategic, tactical, directional, and applicational process of the organization, keeps them on board, involved, and contributing to the organization during the major paradigm shift. Fifth, these organizations seem to have a strong identity, but also a strong ability to rely on partners and to build these partnerships. Partners with whom they collaborate, but whom they do not control. So the notion of equity in partnership, building equity-based partnerships and the values that that represents. Not controlling others, but building ways to negotiate, to in some way manage the conflict, to find in the conflict common ground, and in that common ground to find common purpose and reason to share, to grow, and to benefit together. These were critical elements of being able to thrive in a paradigm shift. Six. These successful organizations produce both business values and societal values. It's not one or the other, or one at the expense of other. They begin to recognize that they advance their own long-term trajectory and value and viability when they also address the social interest and the values of the society and the greater context of which they are a part. 7. These thriving organizations bring together the soft areas, traditionally identified as people, culture, community, and social responsibility, and the hard areas, technology, productivity, and innovation. They're able to recognize that in order to thrive and in order to maintain that continuous trajectory towards long-term viability, they have to balance people, culture, and community with technology, productivity, and innovation, and that balance is a delicate one. Any loss in one side of that balance affects the integrity and viability of the other side. And finally, these thriving organizations in a paradigm shift do not abandon their values in a crisis. In fact, as leaders put them to the test, crises actually serve to strengthen the commitment of these organizations to their values. When an organization loses its values or forgets its values, it loses its direction, it loses its soul, and its ability to compensate for challenges and difficulties that it might find on the way is hardened and made more difficult, and as a result increasingly threatens the organization and challenges its ability to be continuously successful. So finding that goodness of fit is important. These 8 contradictions, if you will, or dichotomies is probably a better way of saying it, that Cantor suggests really are critical now in a transforming world, in a time where we're seeing major paradigm shifts, especially in healthcare organizations, is really, really important to maintain the integrity and value of the organization. The leader's role and the complexity invested in the leader's role is finding the balance, finding those intersections between what appears to be dichotomous or in some way contradictory even, is really critical to maintaining the integrity, the balance, and the viability of the organization as it confronts its own change. I thought that taking just a little bit of time to identify these fundamental characteristics might be a valuable snippet into looking at some of the underpinnings of innovation leadership in a transforming or paradigm-shifting world. Good luck with applying them.